CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded February 11th, 2026. Well, 5 weeks after the United States' murderous assault against Venezuela, it's becoming increasingly difficult to distinguish resistance from acquiescence. As with Mexico's President Claudia Sheinbaum, acting Venezuelan President Delcy Rodriguez has too halted energy exports to Cuba and gone further, agreeing to onerous U.S.-dictated terms for access to Venezuela's oil resources, dressed up in the country's recently reformed hydrocarbon law. And now, reportedly beginning exports to Israel. So what of the popular outrage and demands for resistance to what looks like an armed takeover of the Bolivarian revolutionary movement and all those fighting for a better world new order? Allison Bodine is an activist, author, researcher, and contributing editor for the Fire This Time newspaper. She's too an activist with the Venezuela Solidarity Network and Vancouver's Mobilization Against War and Occupation. Allison served as an election observer in Venezuela in 2024. For both communal and presidential election campaigns, and authored the book Revolution and Counter-Revolution in Venezuela, published by Battle of Ideas Press. Allison Bodine in the first half. And activist, journalist, author, and legitimate BAU disruptor Eve Engler is in BC this week presenting the failure of social democracy, NDP support for militarism, and imperialism. He's written a dozen books, 11 of them being on the perfidious history of Canadian foreign policy, the latest, Canada's Long Fight Against Democracy, co-written with Owen Schock. Eve's tour will land in Victoria February 16th, cross the Strait to Powell River on the 17th, down to Surrey and Burnaby on the 18th and 19th, before heading inland to the Okanagan for Kelowna's Friday, February 20th event. Eve Engler on a political structure to succeed where the NDP continues to fail in the second half. But first, Allison Bodine and the revolution's darkest days. Welcome back to the show, Allison.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a while.
It's been too long, for sure. Allison, before getting to the current threat to Cuba and the escalating blockade there, similar to that preceding U.S. military action against Caracas and President Maduro, I'd like to address the legitimacy of the Maduro government. Our Canadian Prime Minister Carney's first response to the kidnapping of the president and his wife, Celia Flores, also a member of the government, was to question Maduro's electoral bona fides based on the assertion his 2018 election was fraudulent, as if that would somehow justify the American attack. But as well as the 2024 elections, you were too an observer of the 2018 poll. Allison, what did you observe of the Venezuelan democratic process then?
Yeah, I think that's an important question and unfortunately not unexpected response from Prime Minister Carney. Because both during the 2018 and 2024 elections, the government of Canada predicted the outcome in a sense, published articles and statements saying that the democratic process didn't exist in Venezuela, that it was certain to be a stolen election, those sort of rhetoric leading up to the election before it had even, begun. And so it was really a predetermined outcome as far as the government of Canada, government of the United States and other imperialist countries were concerned. Very different than, of course, what I observed on site. Coming down to Venezuela as an international elections observer, one of hundreds of international elections observers, we're welcomed into a country that's in the middle of a vibrant participatory democratic process, one in which people are, well educated about the candidates, know how to vote, have a right to vote. Everyone in Venezuela over the age of 18 is able to vote just using their identification cards, an accessible process where the machines are located, every neighborhood block or so, and a process that's both electronic and paper balloted and verified in both instances, kind of checked against one another in a way that people are familiar with. There's multiple parties on the ballot. The parties are able to be scrutineers both in the actual rooms where voting is taking place and during the vote counts. And all of those practices were upheld in both the 2018 and 2024 election. Now, there were, of course, Venezuela was well aware of these so-called predictions from imperialist countries. So it was often in the news at that time saying, oh, Venezuela isn't allowing outside observers. And I think it's important that we would question why the European Union, for example, has the so-called right to travel to Venezuela and tell them whether they're democracy is functioning or not. But Venezuela did put up certain security guards and didn't let anyone that wanted to come to the country to scrutinize the elections participate. But we were there as international observers. There were international observers from official observation delegations from things like the Latin American Parliament or trained observers from across Latin America. So I saw something that was, a voting process in practice. And I also observed people's general level of like comfort and excitement, and really people feeling like they wanted to vote and that they would be voting. And I think that occurred both when we were in neighborhoods that would be considered more of an opposition neighborhood and in those that would be considered more of a Chavista or pro Bolivarian revolutionary process neighborhood. People were voting both ways, felt comfortable telling us before they voted and after they voted. And really, it was very different than what the mass media was reporting. And I think that being there, being an elections observer, was critical to being able to come back to the United States or Canada, especially, and being able to say what we observed, take videos of people, recording why they had voted. And what marked me the most, especially, was people that definitely understood that if they voted in favor of, their independence and their continued standing up against the U.S. government, especially if they continued the Bolivarian revolutionary process and voted for President Nicolas Maduro, that likely, their material situation would probably get worse. This 2018 came just a few years after the U.S. President Barack Obama first declared Venezuela an unusual and extraordinary threat to U.S. foreign policy, and really started tightening the screws, especially on when it came to sanctions against Venezuela's oil industry. And so when people voted in 2018, they knew that they were voting in a government that would continue to stand up for their independence and self-determination and defy the United States, and that likely things would get more difficult. And they certainly did in 2019 with increased opposition violence funded by the United States. And then when I returned in 2024, for another election, Venezuela's elections, I will say, are, the election schedule is set by the Venezuelan constitution, which was popularly voted and passed in the first years of the administration of President Hugo Chavez. The election schedule means every 5 years a president is elected. So that happened on schedule in 2024 once again, and saw a very similar situation. Saw Venezuela that was beginning to recover from the sanctions, beginning to recover from the COVID-19 pandemic and all the massive economic impacts that happened globally due to that. But once again, saw people engaged, politicized, wanting to vote, voting, celebrating in the streets at the election's results in a very like safe and public way as those were announced. But then unfortunately, just a few hours after the results were announced, we began to see violent acts taking place on the streets coming from, basically thugs or gangs of thugs. So that was the early morning of the elections of 2024, which later came out to be kind of a coup attempt supported by the United States that was attempted to be carried out that day. It was very quickly resolved through, the legal channels and the Venezuelan security forces. And when I returned to Venezuela, actually 1 month after the presidential election, Venezuelans, through street mobilization, had asserted their sovereignty and independence and their belief in the election. So I guess I'd say as a conclusion, you rightfully pointed out that regardless of how an election may have been carried out, the U.S. has no right under international law to kidnap a president and charge them in criminal court on trumped up charges and hold him and his wife, also a parliamentarian, Celia Flores, in prison in the United States. But regardless, neither does Mark Carney have the right to declare who's the rightful president of Venezuela when the people of Venezuela have, in fact, declared that through their constant, mobilization, their continued organization in support of the Bolivarian revolutionary process and the government, Venezuelans are very much empowered and politically engaged. And sometimes I think that's the hardest thing for people that live in a country like Canada or the United States to really wrap your head around, when we're living in an area that is more generally characterized by people's uninvolvement in politics. And so to visit somewhere where it's the opposite is true, that people are very engaged in politics and very supportive, or feel very much like to express their political views and to have opinions and to mobilize in the streets and march on a regular basis. Like, I think being able to understand just how much power is in that and how much the majority of people in Venezuela support the government. And that includes President Nicolas Maduro and Celia Flores, who were kidnapped by the United States. And that has continued through to today, when people in Venezuela are marching in the streets demanding their return. And of course, that's not being shown on any major media across the imperialist countries.
Well, and the violence that you describe after an election returns results that the parties of the North are not happy with. We saw in Nicaragua as well, very similar to what happened in the post-election period in Venezuela, and probably the same actors ultimately behind it. The Canadian government's record in Latin America, especially as it concerns democracy and democratic movements, and we've seen in Chile, Honduras, El Salvador, repeatedly in Venezuela, in Colombia. Canada's record has been terrible. It's got no claim to be an arbiter of anything. I would say that Carney should stick to his own elections. And yet they feel emboldened enough, does the Carney government and the previous governments, to also engage in sanctions similar to the American sanction campaign against Venezuela and other places as well. What kind of sanctions is Canada now levying against Venezuela?
So Canada and Venezuela haven't had a normal diplomatic relationship since the time of that 2018 presidential election. It wasn't an official decision that was reported on in the news, but basically the government of Canada created the conditions at which Venezuela could no longer operate normally diplomatically, in the sense of having an ambassador or anything like that here in the country. A lot due to compliance with U.S. sanctions, and then Canada's own set of sanctions. So just to kind of put some context to sanctions, obviously, are a tool, a murderous genocidal tool used by the United States government and other imperialist countries, including Canada, and, as a form of war without bombs, it's often described as. And then they are one tool within kind of an overall, I would say, like hostile relationship, and kind of a break in this relationship between the government of Canada and the government of Venezuela, brought on by Canada's hostility. So Canada's sanctions against Venezuela, as Canada has done actually with other countries around the world, they've tried to say these are targeted sanctions against individuals. And that continues to be the case, but Canada's implementation of those sanctions and just their general acquiescence to the sanctions regime of the United States has meant that it really just adds to the real impact of sanctions, which comes from countries being unable to operate normally on the world financial market at all. And that's not only because there's an explicit rule that says this bank can't do dealings with the government of Venezuela, but it's also because investors are scared away from making investments. Large commercial companies refuse to participate in contracts because of the general atmosphere that's been created around heavily sanctioned countries like Venezuela. So I think all of those policies have continued. None of that has been reversed, especially during this latest U.S. military buildup against Venezuela that began basically in August of 2025. So Canada's policies have not changed at all, and they continue to be an impedance to Venezuela being able to trade normally on the world stage.
Well, it's not only foreign governments that are terrified to defy the Americans and their main allies, But we've seen, too, now I mentioned at the top that it's becoming increasingly difficult to distinguish resistance from acquiescence within Venezuela. Delcy Rodriguez has amended Hugo Chavez's hydrocarbon law. The oil industry looks to be captured. It's a sensitive issue now because I know that there's a huge propaganda war going on, especially up here in the north. There are attempts to dishearten supporters of Venezuela and Venezuelans themselves to make them lose faith in their own government. At the same time, it certainly looks like surrender. Today, just as we're speaking, the American energy minister is landing in Caracas. It's expected that they're there to deliver terms. U.S. Energy Secretary Chris Wright is on the ground there. We're not sure what exactly is going to be the agenda there, but we can imagine. What about those thousands in the street? You say we didn't see them on TV. We wouldn't expect the CBC to feature something positive in that light. But what's the reaction within Venezuela amongst the people you know there to the direction of the Rodriguez government right now in regards not only to the oil industry, but what looks to be a, I don't know, is this the end of the Bolivarian project?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely far too early. I think months ago a lot of conversations were speculating on would the U.S. invade Venezuela, would the U.S. bomb Venezuela, and a lot of those discussions, you know, are kind of caught in a speculative space until time will tell. And I think we're in a similar situation here. I can only look towards the millions of people that have been mobilizing in the streets for the return of President Maduro and parliamentarian Celia Flores. They've done so often at the direction of different ministries that are part of the government, including the presidency. These are rallies that are organized by grassroots people participating in some cases, but also calls from the Bolivarian government and the government of Delcy Rodriguez to continue mobilizing. So really establishing that relationship as one of support of the people. And I'll say that, you know, people I've talked to and just the interviews I witnessed at those demonstrations, people feel a lot of conviction about continuing to defend their independence and self-determination, and that part of that being that Delcy Rodriguez is, you know, being acting president. I think it's important we use the word acting president. Major media is often using the word interim, which is another bit of a psychological misinformation part of this campaign against Venezuela and other countries to use words that are not what's actually being used in the country. But acting president Delcy Rodriguez and her government, including some new ministerial appointments, is following a constitutional process. She was vice president, so therefore now she is acting president in this extraordinary condition of the kidnapping of President Maduro. And then the Parliament of Venezuela took office as it was scheduled to do and it was established at the beginning of January. So the hydrocarbon law, which you referred to, which was introduced by Chavez in 2001 and again in 2007, had some changes made to increase Venezuelans' ability to extract profits from the oil industry. There have been changes made to that that were discussed in Parliament by, you know, many members of Parliament. And it is difficult. And I think, you know, we're not really going to be able to parse apart exactly what the terms of deals are. A lot of these are the U.S. government and oil companies aren't revealing the deals of the letter of these deals, but we can definitely say that they're being made at gunpoint and with coercion. I mean, the kidnapping of the president on January 3rd was the result and kind of accumulation of the United States' largest military buildup in the Caribbean since the 1950s. It was the result of a complete naval blockade that the U.S. had started to impose that included the stopping and you know, kidnapping of oil tankers and redirecting of oil tankers. And so I think as an extension of that, we should be on alert. But really, we should also make sure, like you said, that we're vigilant about what the media is reporting, because there is an attempt to create divisions in Venezuelan society because they're still looking for further regime change. We've also heard discussed from various members of the U.S. administration, where they're saying, you know, we're signaling through the media, at least, you know, we're not quite we're not quite happy with what's happening, and things could always get worse again, Venezuela, while at the same time negotiating with Venezuela. And I think we have to firmly stand by the right of Venezuela to negotiate to their sovereignty and self-determination and their right to assert their independence, but to understand that there is a gun to Venezuela's head still, as we observe, especially what's happening with the oil industry.
Well, yes, it's incredible times, and Carney might do well to protect himself before lending legitimacy to American methods, because it might well be him in the dock next. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Allison Bodine. Allison's an activist, author, researcher, and contributing editor to the Fire This Time newspaper. She's a longtime activist with the Venezuela Solidarity Network and Vancouver's Mobilization Against War and Occupation. She's been an observer to Venezuelan elections in 2024 and 2018, as we've been discussing. She's the author, too, of the book Revolution and Counter-Revolution in Venezuela, ordering details soon to follow. Allison, now, when I said that it wasn't just foreign investors and foreign countries that are scared away by the brutish approach of our neighbor south, Venezuela, too, has joined, in a sense, a sanctioned campaign against Cuba. This must be a twist of the knife unimaginable, along with Mexico as well, Cuba's longtime stalwart supporter, both of them going along with the American diktat that they cannot export any oil products to Cuba right now. Cuba, I've heard referred to as the next Gaza, is, as we're sitting here chatting amiably, you and I, the people in Cuba are being slowly strangulated economically and, well, in every way, as we've seen in Gaza. You're a longtime Cuba activist as well. What are you hearing from your friends there, Allison?
Yeah, these escalated attacks definitely from the United States towards Cuba, where the U.S. has essentially vowed to cut Cuba off from oil, which translates to starvation. It translates to an asphyxiation of the economy. People know a lot of Cuba's power grid depends on oil. It's an island. It's, you know, it's worked towards diversifying its power grid, but still a large dependency on oil, as well as the agricultural industry. I think that this has been, it's a developing situation still, and I think we cannot discount the resilience and resistance of the Cuban people, especially, who have been under a constant attack since the Cuban Revolution in 1959 from the United States government, only, 90 miles away from their shores. So the Cuban people have withstood tremendous pressure from the United States and a genocidal policy of blockade that's persisted for over 67 years. And I think they will continue to resist under all sorts of conditions. I will also say that the government of Mexico and President Claudia Sheinbaum have sent humanitarian aid, urgent humanitarian aid. They have two large cargo ships full of this aid. One, I believe, has already landed or is on his way, and the other is being prepared. So they've continued to support Cuba in other ways. I very much want to say that, Cuba is not completely isolated in the way that the U.S. would like to paint or would like to imagine. And I think, as this was the case with Venezuela, the U.S. government is often underestimating the resilience and commitment of people, of everyday people, to defend their independence and sovereignty. And I think it's also important that we view what the United States is doing in the Western Hemisphere and their military buildup and, blatant violations of international law and murderous policies. I think it's important we understand where that's coming from, that we take a step back and we say, well, what is so different about today than it was 6 months ago? How the U.S., has been trying, and through various methods, to create regime change against especially the Cuban government since 1959, this escalation, I think we really have to see as coming from a point of maybe not quite desperation, but a sense of urgency coming from the Trump administration in response to U.S.'s declining influence globally and the consequent and opposite growing influence of especially China in Latin America. China has a significant presence in Latin American countries and their economic and social development. And I think the U.S. attacks and attempts to isolate countries like Cuba and Venezuela that have a relationship with China is really in response to this and in response to their declining position, a real attempt to try and open up new markets across Latin America, which is to say that I don't think they see this as a, you know, it's not a short game. This is a strategic question. It's one that we're going to see. I think the U.S. policies shift, go back and forth, like them try different attempts to further carry forward this agenda of confrontation with China and trying to stand up against China's growing influence. And unfortunately, I think it's going to come with more anti-human policies by the United States in Latin America. But I don't think this is a short-term campaign of either the Trump administration or subsequent U.S. administrations. So I do think it's important that our understanding of this, of the U.S. attacks, as you've said, is, you know, focused also on our position of solidarity with the people of Latin America, and the in particular in Cuba, with Cuba's revolutionary government and the people of Cuba that are going to come under this increasing pressure. You know, they, I often say to people, like, the people of Cuba and Venezuela, like, they know what to do. They know how to mobilize in the streets and defend themselves. They know how to fight against 60 years of a brutal blockade, and how to come out victorious with their, you know, their dignity and their independence intact. It's really us living in imperialist countries that have our work cut out for us. Like, us, our our fight to get the boot of the United States off the neck of countries like Cuba is, you know, it's, we really have to see this time as an urgent time for us to figure that out and to really build movements in solidarity with people in Latin America that are standing up against the war machine of the United States.
Well, as Canadians, I think it's time we recognize that Canada too has a boot, if a smaller one, on those same necks. It's not only a supporter of the American boot, it is booting in its own in its own right. Finally, Don Davies, the NDP interim leader, I'll say properly in his case, questioned the government in the House, asking if Canada would uphold independent foreign policy of the United States. I'm sure that got a lot of laughs in the back rooms afterwards. He was answered by our Minister of Foreign Affairs, Anita Anand, about Cuba, that that the Canadian government is, quote, deeply concerned, and they're working, they say, with Cuban authorities. Their top priority is the safety and security always of Canadians, and they're working on evacuating Canadians. That's all they have to say. They're not going to break any embargoes here either. Allison, we're fast out of time. Please tell us about Revolution and Counter-Revolution in Venezuela, your book. Where can people get it?
So that's a book that is available from Battle of Ideas Press. So battleofideaspress.com is where you can find it. Also firethistime.net. You can find links there, as well as helpful links to Cuba solidarity and Venezuela solidarity organizing taking place across North America. Because like I said, this time, it's time that we take all this, you know, information, and we really figure out how to act and how to take active solidarity with people in Cuba, Venezuela, and across Latin America.
Well, I have a feeling that you and I won't have 7 years time luxury before we speak the next time. Perhaps we can do it much sooner than that. I'm going to take a brief break now, and I'll be joined after the break by Eve Angler. He's going to be in BC at the end of this week doing a four city stop, or was it five? And we'll talk about that and some of the other things going on. Thanks a lot, Allison, for coming on again and sharing your experience.
Thank you, Chris. Pleasure to talk to you today.
Well, I gotta think that we're not alone.
I'm sitting in my house watching all this happen, and I've arrived to a point where I just can't keep my mouth shut anymore.
Guerrilla Radio, you're not alone.
So was elected, like every time he ran. When his socialists took power, that's when the changes began. The opposition started attacking every forward move, but reforms went ahead, the people's welfare improved. A land of such riches that had always gone to so few was reaching places ignored since 1492 in Venezuela. Poured into the streets to stop the coup back then. They got the man that they elected back into power again. The Bolivarian Revolution became famous worldwide. Soon other socialist governments swept in a red tide. Between